Hello,
and welcome to this episode of the British Journal of Nursing podcast. I'm your host, Sean Boyle, editor of the British Journal of Nursing, and today's episode asks the question, is the UK's nursing research model broken? So, for many nurses, research can feel like a distant part of their role, something that happens in journals, conferences, or academic settings, and is far removed from the wards and clinics where care is actually delivered. Yet the questions researchers ask, the evidence they generate and the innovations they test have the potential to transform everyday nursing practice across the UK. Nursing research is about so much more than data and publications. It's about shaping how care is delivered, influencing policy, and ultimately improving patient outcomes. Across the NHS, research-led nursing has the power to elevate the profession, but structural challenges, resource limitations, and systemic barriers often prevent its full impact from being realised. In this episode, I'm speaking with Dr. Oladayo Biferin and Dr. Deborah Morgan. Oladayo is a senior lecturer in mental health nursing at Liverpool John Moores University, a research effectiveness lead at Merseycare NHS Foundation Trust, and one of the NIHR senior research leaders. Deborah is a senior lecturer in mental health nursing at Liverpool John Moores University. Collectively, we're going to explore whether the UK's nursing research model is broken, what lessons might be learned from international models like John Hopkins in the United States, and how the profession can evolve to better integrate evidence into practice. Together, we'll discuss the challenges, opportunities, and future of nursing research work that could define the way care is delivered across the country in the years moving forwards. Deborah, Oladayo, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sean.
Thank you for having us.
So just to start off with, and this is a question to the pair of you or whoever wants to take it. In your experience, what are the main barriers within the NHS that limit the implementation of nursing research findings into everyday practice? So if I've conducted some research and I've got some findings that are good to go, what's the process like between finishing that research piece and then maybe seeing it in day-to-day practice?
I strongly believe that in the front end of things, it is a nurse education. Because if we haven't been able to produce nurses who can think as scientists, I would argue, that is the first sort of major barrier, I would say. So nurse education. The second element there is the consequences of that, which is for me, the lack of leadership. When I say leadership, I don't mean managers. I mean people that can see the future and can craft that journey to sort of make it happen. But because they've not been socialized themselves to actually think like that in terms of translating evidence into practice, and I talk there, that's just generally speaking, then it's very alien to start thinking of creating a pathway for other people. Because it's a fact that to be a nurse, regardless of your banding, 5, 6, 7, entry point, enhanced point, advanced point, consultant point, you have 4 proficiencies, pillars. You have your clinical pillar, you have your leadership pillar, you have your education pillar, and you have your research pillar. But what is very evident is if you think of a stool, and I'm using this analogy that I'm borrowing from Dr. Joe Cooper, if you have a stool with 4 legs and you have 3 legs combined into 1, which is now the clinical pillar, which is the clinical fat leg, and you have the other 3 legs competing to sort of find where to stay. That is what that looks like today. So for me, it goes back to that, working in a very stifled environment where it's very operation driven, managers that want to deliver those KPIs, and the KPIs that are also not actually providing opportunities for innovation to happen. I hope I've answered those questions.
Yeah, I thought that was really effective. I think it's interesting to look at the way these barriers work across all these different aspects of nursing. I've spoken on previous episodes about how leadership in all forms can impact the way, you know, nurses work in their role. And I think it's important to also recognize that the issues surrounding leadership can also manifest in these kind of research projects. So it's all well and good to take part in research with the hope being to improve general practice or get some more insights into how nursing's working. But research in the first place is quite an intimidating process to get involved in. And unless you've got some like either supervision or even just like a peer that you can speak to about it to help guide you in that process, the pitfalls, whether they're real or imagined, can do more harm than someone coming along and saying, you know what, this research is wrong or don't do that. You know what I mean? People can psych themselves out as opposed to it being some sort of external factor. So I think leadership's really important, and I'm glad you've raised the kind of profile of it. In terms of...
And I think just to add to the implementation of research, before you even get down to individual areas such as nursing or medicine or paramedicine or wherever, from the very get-go, you've got the big barrier that it typically takes between 15 and 17 years to get new research implemented anyway. And that's before you even factor in, have you got the research prepared nurses? Have you got the research enabling leadership? So you've got that huge barrier from the get-go. And then that just kind of trickles down to all those other things that Oladeo was mentioning.
I didn't realize it was did you say 15 to 17 year gap?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. So by which time is it even new knowledge? You know, by the time it actually gets to the bedside, is it actually new knowledge? Is there better knowledge coming behind? So reducing that bench to bedside lag is hugely important.
And just to, again, add to that, and the only way, thinking about barriers at the moment, I was reading an article recently that spoke about, so when you talk about the clinical academic pathway, so one of the key ways I strongly believe can help us reduce 15, 17 years drastically is if you have clinical staff on the front line actually generating those evidence. So as they go in their practice, they can apply them. Globally, we have not 0.1% of nurses and midwives in clinical academic roles, compared to 4.6% of doctors. So what is really clear is the voices of nurses is missing at the top. But it's good to see very quickly, and we can get back to that in terms of what is that currently happening now in the UK context in terms of funding going to that space. But again, funding is not enough, and that takes us back to the fundamentals, nurse education, and then in practice, leadership.
I know you mentioned globally just there, but if we take a little closer look at the NHS itself, in both of your opinions, how effective is the NHS at sort of disseminating these kind of research findings? I know you mentioned 15, 17 years, but on top of that, if it does get to the point where, okay, it's great, we've got these findings, we want to implement them, is that often done across the NHS? Is it done on a more local level? Is it done with patient care in mind, or is it done with kind of a closer attune to like budgets or what's possible or that kind of thing?
It's not that clear cut is what I would say. But generally speaking, what is clear is that we have this, I will use the word isolation. So you have your HEIs, so higher education institutions, universities who are quite savvy in terms of getting that big grant. Unfortunately, they come to the NHS to then recruit. NHS would get some money for meeting recruitment target. So that's where your capitalism starts to sort of come through. And when it comes to recruitment, now it's a case of if your nurses are not part of that research team, for example, they recruit, they join your studies, you have your evidence, and off you go on to the next time when there's a new project. So that already is a point of failure. So in the context of dissemination, nurses would get involved, but they don't tend to know what the findings are, and they don't know how to take the findings into clinical practice. So that is, again, an example of bad investment of time. Then you also think about, and I'll let Deb come through here, because this is one thing Deb has done really well in the state. When you now think about the ones that are meant to be accessible, so things like your quality improvement, where it's a case of how do we look at evidence out there and use the evidence to shape what we currently do need so we can innovate, then you hear things like, we don't have time. Now, I've heard that for such a long time that one day people say that, I don't hear that anymore. What I hear is, I don't have the skill set to do this. Mm-hmm. But it takes courage to say that. There would never be a time. There was no time. COVID happened. We found the time. So if it's really important, I'm talking about effectiveness of dissemination, then the nurses need to be part and parcel of the conversation from the outset. Deb, I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously quality improvement is kind of my background coming from the States. And, you know, I think we'll talk a little bit later about the DMP model and how that kind of embeds QI. But really, part of doing QI and doing it well and having those skills that Olidea mentioned is being able to identify the economic advantages of a project, the resource advantages, being able to make the argument for sustainability and building sustainability into the project. So that can help get over that argument of we don't have time, because if you can show through your rigorously designed QI initiative that you're actually going to save time or you're going to save resources, that's something that nurses can really make a difference in, not just to patient outcomes, which obviously are, you know, the most important, but also to the organization as well, and also to the use of resources and staffing and all those kind of things. And I think, you know, you mentioned, Sean, that kind of almost that fear and the research can be very intimidating. It absolutely can. But, you know, what we did in our paper as well, and what Olidea and I both very firmly believe in, is kind of redefining research and looking at it as a continuum, not just original research with this big scary ivory towers approach, you know, that not everybody can access. But the research is a continuum, and there's three very distinct elements of it. There's evidence-based practice, there's quality improvement, and there's original research. And as we just talked about with that 15 to 17 year lag, without the evidence-based practice, without the quality improvement, that research is potentially just going to sit on a shelf and gather dust. It's not actually going to get implemented and get to the bedside. So I think quality improvement is something that's far more accessible for nurses as well, to dip their toe into that research continuum and possibly find an aspect of it that they enjoy better than the original research as well, which, you know, is kind of true for me. I love quality improvement.
And if I could just jump in, I mean, to come back, that is, translation and ownership are the choking points we currently have. Now, if those are the two sort of choking points, it makes logical sense that if you upskill your staff, then you can solve dismantle that choking point. But what tends to happen, and I say this in a critical way, not in any way condescending, is that we now have people using different words, service development, service improvement, different languages to solve, stay away from the research language. And that is not doing us any favor. So we're just kicking the can down the road. What needs to happen is we need to think about how we are upskilling our staff members who are going to do QIs, clinical audits, service evaluations, and they are going to do it in a robust way. Mm-hmm. And I will argue that the same skill set you need to do a small QI project is very transferable into original research. So that's an in for anyone who wants to do something innovative, who wants to do something different. And I'm pleased to say that now I think I can say that even at the national level, that is now being taken into consideration. Because if you go for NIHR pre-support application and you want to do a quality improvement project, I see people are getting some success in that at the moment. And that is a good place to start. But there needs to also be a good transformational approach between universities and NHS organizations. It cannot continue to be transactional. As a nurse, why do I need to be in the university and have nothing to do with the clinical environment? Who made that happen? It's a funding stream. Something needs to happen in the middle. And my experience when I was at the university was when I was in placement and I took a critical question to the university when I was in my lecture. And one of these lecturers said to me, "What happens in practice stays in practice." There you go. And that is where it all stems from. Where I am today is because of that statement. Think, how dare you say that? A nurse educator doesn't make you less of a clinician. And that's where we need to sort of change the conversation we're having in the UK context.
Talking about bridging the gap between primary, secondary care and the research side of things, why is it important for nurses to involve themselves in research in the first place?
I think nurses are by nature curious people. You know, they're problem solvers. And just by the very nature of the role, by the very holistic nature of the role, that they play with patients, with populations, with families and caregivers and everything, they are uniquely placed to identify clinical gaps, areas where things could be done better. I mean, we're going to talk about Johns Hopkins later on, but they say that aha moment that nurses have. I mean, we've all had it, you know, on the floor in a clinic, and we've seen either a patient journey, we thought this could be done better. And nurses are just ideally placed to identify those clinical gaps and then go and do the research. I'll use the term research loosely, but what does the evidence say? Is there already evidence-based practice here? If so, is this something we could do a quality improvement and actually bring that research to the bedside? If not, maybe it's you know, an opportunity for an original research project. But nurses have the access to a whole host of clinical problems and clinical gaps. And they are problem solvers. They are curious by nature. And we just need to harness that.
And if I can just come to that point as well, that for any profession to be credible, I would argue that it's a lot of times your academic output is your currency. Mm-hmm. So when we are here and we are asking for pay rise or painful, one of the consequences that we're suffering today is because our credibility has been very value driven, which is not a problem, but it gets to a point where the value is no longer enough. It's the, what is the outcome? And we know that, you know, when you have qualified nurses, we save lives. And I know that the system demands more of nurses, but we also need to be quite smart about how we portray ourselves. And for me here is, if we as a profession, as nurses, if we are the ones that have access to all these partners, we need to harness that. It goes back to Deb's point. But one of the things I think we're not doing really well at this point in time is, when we talk about evidence-based practice, the conversation is moving very quickly to patient public involvement engagement. Is an element of evidence-based practice. For something to be evidence-based practice, you need your clinical expertise, you need your patient's preferences, you need your theoretical understanding. Those things must intersect at every given point in time. So when someone thinks, this is what I know as a clinician, that is not evidence-based practice. If a patient comes to you and says, this is what I want from my care, and that's why sometimes it bothers me. You go to your GP these days and you get told, what do you want? That element of consumerism is coming through into our systems. And the only way to combat that is having a workforce that is astute, that can use their skill set to actually make a different argument. And things, because at this point in time, things get very political very quickly. And I say that in the context of the NHS neighborhood flagship policy that is coming through now. You know, it's fantastic. But I would argue that if you don't have your clinicians who are evidence-based in the true sense of it, you cannot sustain that model. If you want to get rid of managers are fantastic. But it is the context of managers managing managers, and it becomes so bureaucratic. Then you've got to give people the freedom to be autonomous as they are meant to be. And that's where research can help us to solve, provide counter-argument.
Yeah, and I think my experience in the States, the profession of nursing, I think, is seen and portrayed very differently. And as nurses in the States, we are constantly being told to practice to the top of our license. We're being told to strive for that professionalism, and that body of nursing research is such an integral part of us being a respected profession, which, you know, nursing is generally a very respected profession. But I think we have to have that body of nursing knowledge, and then using that nursing knowledge, actually implementing it, actually getting it to the patient bedside, to really reflect that professionalism.
So you mentioned the Johns Hopkins model before, when discussing your work in the States. Do you mind just briefly explaining to me and to our listeners what the Johns Hopkins model of evidence-based practice is, and what distinguishes it from the UK approach?
Yes, so I think when we say Johns Hopkins model, there's actually a couple of elements. There is a specific Johns Hopkins model of evidence-based practice, which so Johns Hopkins, for those who aren't familiar, is one of the original and most well-respected research universities in the US. They have the university element, which largely focuses on medical school, nursing school, other health studies, but they also have the Johns Hopkins medical system as well. A lot of the universities in the States have academic medical systems attached to them, which is one of the benefits of the system I think we'll talk about a little bit later on. So Johns Hopkins actually has their own evidence-based practice model, which is widely renowned, used globally. But the element of Johns Hopkins that I really think is gold standard for nurses in research is their Center for Nursing Inquiry. And that is an organization that's housed within Johns Hopkins, which really encourages, supports, harnesses their nurses within their system and their nursing students to really grow themselves as researchers and to explore the three different aspects of nursing inquiry, which is the evidence-based practice, which is the QI and is the original research. And they have just a myriad of resources. They have podcasts, they have videos. These are all accessible to the public, by the way. They're actually very collaborative. They have toolkits, which if you contact them, they will gladly share all of their toolkits and materials with you. But it's really that they are nurturing. They are saying to their nurses, we want you to bring us your clinical problems. We want you to identify the clinical gaps, and then we will work with you to identify the evidence or to generate the evidence, to implement the evidence. And you can actually access their project dashboard through their website. And last time I checked, I think they had something like 122 active nurse-led projects. And of those, over 80 were quality improvement. So they really are kind of, they're not just talking the talk there at Johns Hopkins, they're actually backing it up with action and just positively empowering their nurses to be nurse scientists. And nurses across the board, they don't have to identify as academics or researchers. These are floor nurses working with patients day in, day out. And Johns Hopkins are saying, we want to empower you to be nurse scientists. And it really is, I think, the gold standard of models.
And what are the outcomes of this? Like, do you see a real tangible uptake of research findings or research at the bedside? Are these outcomes measurable, or is it kind of more of a attitude, an environment, a kind of mindset of being able to pursue any kind of leads you want as a nurse and develop yourself both like professionally, but also among your peers?
Yeah, so I can only speak about my own experience, and I was very lucky to work. The two hospital systems I worked in the States were both academic health systems. I started my nursing career at UT Southwestern in Dallas. And again, very similar cultures to Johns Hopkins, very much that bring us a problem, let's identify a solution and work on it. And as a brand new nurse to the floor, I identified that the way we oriented new nurse interns to the psychiatric units were based essentially on all of the physical health units. There was nothing nuanced for psychiatry. So I went to leadership, explained the problem, proposed some models based on evidence, and was incredibly encouraged to implement that, which we did. So I do feel that if you've got that environment and you know you've got that leadership support and you know that you are going to be supported to do this, it does definitely. Again, it's going to come down to the individual, I think, to some degree. Not everybody wants to do that, and that's okay. But I think you've got a lot of nurses out there that probably would love to be involved in improvement or in research or in, you know, improving patient and system outcomes. So just providing that culture and that environment is hugely important.
It's a good question you asked, Sean, because one of the things I get a side comment around the work I do is around who says that the research active organizations have better outcomes. When you get those questions, the first time I heard that question, I felt, what kind of question is that? But then I had to sort of take my step back and think about, actually, the assumption that people know what we know is not going to allow us to sort of build those relationships, which is crucial for the work we are doing. What I can say, again, from my own personal experience, is the support I'm supporting currently a nurse who is currently looking at the data we record, and now we are finding some gaps in the data, which you could argue that the data that is informing practice is not grounded in reality. So imagine if we're able to fix that at low cost compared to you going to a university and ask for an academic to come and fix that for you, that is you saving money. That is you upskilling your staff member. That is you having the right data. So when the NHS talks about digital transformation, oftentimes I hear that and I think to myself, unless we get our data right, that transformation might be a pseudo one. And that's again, unless you have your clinicians who are able to solve, have the time protected to do that work, that is not answer on patient, but it's equally important so that when we put answer on patient, we are doing the right things. Because I hear a lot of nursing students coming through and they would say things like, I'm good by the bedside. I'm not very good academically. And it's like, who was born to be good academically? Who was born to be good on the bedside? These are the attitudes that we need to solve change. These are the thinking we need to solve challenge. Because you can't go into medicine and say, I'm not good academically. You can't go into public health and say, I'm not. And this is the system we have in the UK context that we need to solve, push back on, and provide alternatives, narrative to support the workforce to grow.
I think, Oladeh, you've hit on a really good point there. I think there's a lot of imposter syndrome amongst nurses when it comes to research and academic endeavours. You know, so that is, and you touched on at the beginning as well, it's something we need to really address from the get-go, from level four nursing programs, and really empower nursing students to believe in themselves as future researchers, as future, you know, translational scientists, all of those things. Certainly a multi-layered problem.
So looking at the John Hopkins model in the US, it sounds great. And it sounds like it really addresses some of the issues that we've raised regarding how research is implemented, but also kind of pushed by the NHS and in the UK. So, and forgive me if I'm barking up the wrong tree here, but can we not just implement that model in the UK? Can we not just bring that into the NHS? Like, what are the barriers that, one, either stop us doing that, or two, are the factors that might have slowed the kind of implementation of these kind of systems?
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge over here, and certainly the one that I think I felt most acutely, is the disconnect between academic nursing and clinical nursing. So when we'll talk a little bit about the DNP model as well, because that is something that I think we could implement something along those lines here in the UK. But when I worked at the University of Utah, their model was if you were a clinical faculty member, you also maintained a clinical appointment. So you didn't have nursing academics that never saw a patient. You had nursing academics that went out for, say, 2 or 3 days a week, saw patients. University of Utah College of Nursing even had their own staffed clinics. I worked for their psychiatric clinic and they had several satellites of that. So that, you know, kept you involved with clinical practice. It also helped with your teaching because you brought back real life scenarios to the students. The students, I think, respect you more if they know you're out there actually seeing patients as well. But it also helps you be there in clinical practice, seeing where the gaps are. You know, and then you bring your academic skills, you wearing those two hats, and they marry really well. I can't see that happening quickly overnight here just because of the way the system there is such that divide between the university element and the practice element. I think we'd have to build different relationships with the NHS Trust. Now we have brilliant relationships with them on the practice placement side. You know, the universities have those really close relationships. We have our placement support units and everything who work really, really well with the trusts and with their educators and everything. And it's a really great two-way relationship. Maybe some kind of replication of that on the research quality improvement side might help bridge that gap. But that's going to take both the HEIs and the trusts to actually want to do that.
And just to quickly jump in on that front is at the moment, and this is just my understanding, that we have an operations pathway for development for staff. Why don't we have a parallel pathway for research as well? At the moment, NHS would sponsor or send their students to HEIs, they get trained, off they go, and they don't get any more support from academics in the organization. Mm-hmm. That's transactional. We need something transformational where you can also have academics who have vested interest within the NHS organization to sort of upskill those staff members. And I would say the role I play at the moment is a bespoke element of that. But I'm able to be where I am today, and this is a shout out to nurse leaders like Ruth Hendicott, Joe Cooper, Roxanne Crosby-Wobi. These are nurses who are allowing us to be where we are today in the context of I went for a fellowship that brought me out of my academic commitment to support that pot, to support within the NHS. And I would say that's a good investment. So we now need to have leadership around AGIs who can actually walk the talk, to stop talking and actually look at this expertise that your academic staff can give the NHS and work out a model. Because I don't see why we can't have your student nurses, then a pre-reg research skill training, you go into a clinical academic fellow post, you become a doctoral fellow, that leads you to being a consultant nurse in research. There's a pathway here that we can create. And again, that leads to you becoming a research director. At the moment, we have medics dominate the research directorate space. Why are we not having nurses in those spaces? And that is something that needs to change if really we want to move at scale. So to Deb's point, it's doable, but it takes me to the point I raised in the first instance, is our nurse education, our HEI current way of thinking, you come to us, as well as thinking through in terms of leadership. Who is that person who is going to walk the talk and actually make this accessible for everyone? And I must very say very quickly, I am a mental health nurse by background. I still very much struggle with this idea of branding us as all nurses, because we're not the same thing. So when you look at the data at the moment, what you see is nurses. How many of those numbers are mental health nurses? How many of those numbers are your children and young people, children's nurses? Because unless we get those granular data, we wouldn't know how best to support different disciplines. And I think that's a crucial point. Because at the moment, we know that at the national level, nurses, your AHPs, are not leading research as compared to your medics, methodologists. But that's not going to change overnight. Now the funding is there, and it's really, really reassuring to see that people are applying for the funding. But it is a hell of a work to get those clinical staff the right support. And that is not fair.
I think another approach as well is the Doctor of Nursing Practice program in the US, which is it's a doctoral degree that's clinical leadership systems focused rather than original research. So it kind of complements the PhD. And the American Association Accreditation for Nurses called back in 2004 for the DNP to become the entry point for advanced practice nurses. That hasn't been accepted as yet, but the DNP is vastly growing in popularity. There's about 420 programs with another 100 going through accreditation at the moment. And one of the key aspects of the DNP is to prepare doctorally prepared nurses who are going to go and change health systems and do that in an evidence-based, rigorous way. So the way I've always likened it to is our PhD colleagues generate the new knowledge through their original research, and they hand the baton over to the DNPs, who then implement it into the bedside. And those, not everybody needs to be doctorally educated, but having that layer of nurses trained on this side of the research continuum brings up the newer nurses, the less experienced nurses, and actually involves them in projects that they can see within their clinical settings. So I think it's, you know, from the bottom up and the top down as well.
Yeah, I think it's interesting when talking about how these changes could be implemented into the health service in the UK. And it kind of reminds me of the gap between research and implementation on a smaller basis. So you were saying it's like 15 to 20 years between research and implementation at the bedside. It almost feels like unless there's a deliberate effort to reform how the UK's research and nursing frameworks work as a whole, it might also take 15 to 20 years of like granular inch by inch change. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I do feel like that DNP model has been, and again, it's not generally adopted as being that's your entry route to advanced practice there. But I do feel they've made a bigger movement more quickly in the States than it feels like there is in the UK. And it's also, I think it's also helped with the professionalism, especially of advanced practice as well, having that doctoral training, that doctoral preparation as well. And I know from working in very competitive academic medical settings, I was respected by the physicians to bring my ideas to the table and to bring my projects to the table and to be part of that team with them. So I do think that kind of model really does advance the professionalism of nursing as well and brings that research element along with it.
So do you think the answer, I mean, not that there is a sort of simple equation, but is one of the solutions or a potential solution kind of like a hybrid model that combines aspects of the US systems, whether it's the DNP or the Johns Hopkins, with the current NHS model? Are there aspects that you think could be more easily integrated into what we're doing at the moment?
I'll defer to Oladeo on how it could be integrated to the NHS because I, full disclosure, I have no NHS experience. But I will say that, and Oladeo keeps telling me that I'm very American, so maybe I have picked up more of it than I expected. But just the American system, nursing system in general, seems to be much more action-focused. There seems to be much more of a keen sense of professionalism, of advancing the nursing profession, of not, you know, of moving so far away from that task-oriented doctor's assistants. So if we could harness, I think, some of that enthusiasm and some of that drive here in the UK, we've certainly got the capabilities, the ability amongst our nursing profession. I think it's just harnessing that enthusiasm, that knowledge base, and supporting getting it out there.
I completely agree with that. And I think the context for us in the UK is that our foundation has been, it's a value-driven model. Consequently, and with due respect to my colleagues, we do a lot of ego stroking. And that then leads into political conversations, whether we like it or not. And in all of that, the question I do ask all the time is, where is the people plan for this? Because somehow in translation, we forget that it is about people's careers. And we can't just keep waiting until somebody wakes up and say, I want to reform. So something, and things that, I mean, since we had the Chief Nursing England Research Plan, since 2021, there's been a very massive momentum. But there's still that bottleneck around who is going to have the courage to release 20 staff in 1 year, in 5 years, they have their doctorate, they come back to the system, they can supervise other ones, and the system will start to, we now have a sustainable model. Which chief nurse is going to sort of push for that is the question. And I understand they would say the KPIs and the operations, but at the end of the day, if we really want to provide evidence-based care for our patients, this is the least we should ask for. So in the context of what the answer might look like, for me, it is as clear as day that we need a parallel pathway like your operations folks. Not everyone wants to go into clinical operations. Operations is fine, but people have to have different pathways. And part of that is when you have your doctorate and you talk about impact, then develop another sort of DMP model that can then translate that into clinical practice. But for that to happen, these nurses must be co-investigators. They must be supported to be named on grant application. How do you write a grant? But you need to have the time invested to write in the first instance. And if you don't want to write a grant, how do I help support to recruit onto studies? And then how do I help you take the findings into my clinical practice? There has to be a system that people can communicate effectively, that it doesn't have to be additional work, additional email to that person. If I've done the work and someone, a clinical lead is part of the team, and they've done something based on the evidence, they write me an email to say, we've done this today. And it's a joy to see such email, not a project that just starts, finishes, talk about it. In reality, nothing is changing. What is the point?
And I also think, you know, we're talking a lot about the NHS here. I think we've also got to take a look inwardly as well at the HEI and nursing academics who are teaching the future nurses, because we're equally having to fight for the time to do research and the support to do that. You know, so it's not that we're sat in some ivory towers just doing all this research all day. We're also having to defend that time and defend that area of our role here in academia as well, which you can guarantee you don't have to do in medicine or in some of the other academic subjects.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I've just been making some notes as you've been talking, trying to think of like three key points or messages to kind of leave the subject on. And correct me if I'm wrong, I've kind of tried to distill it down to agency, enthusiasm, and concrete pathways for trying to develop the research model moving forwards. I think what you've said about I've used the word enthusiasm, but it really refers to kind of the ambition and the scope that US nursing really seems to have in abundance and trying to integrate that over here. I think that might be needed as part of like a wider push across a range of different nursing issues relating to either retention or career development or workforce planning and that kind of thing. But I think it's important to see research not as this, as you were saying earlier, this kind of like ivory tower separate entity. It's something that really mm-hmm. should be integrated into nursing at every single level, especially regarding like service evaluations or quality improvement or all these different kind of things that can be implemented at a variety of different levels and across a variety of different roles. I wanted to ask, because I know we've done some work with this in the past, if one of our listeners wanted to read more about this or kind of get a bit more information regarding the kind of way research can work and that kind of thing, do you have any resources you'd recommend for them?
I mean, I would definitely recommend if somebody's really just curious looking at the different options within the research continuum to go to the John Hopkins Center for Nursing Inquiry website. It's brilliant. And like I said, it breaks out the evidence-based practice, quality improvement research, provides a whole host of podcasts, videos, tools, how to get started. I mean, literally from step, you know, A through to step Z. I mean, it's really very comprehensive. And that'd be a really good, and it's very user-friendly. They are trying to take away that mystique and that, you know, that ivory tower element. So for somebody who just literally wanted to dip a toe and take a look and see, oh, can I see myself doing this? There's great examples of nurse-led projects that have come from those aha moments. So take a look at that and start poking around in there and start thinking, you know, about what your clinical passion or your clinical gap could be. And then maybe start to develop the seedlings of a project.
And if I take it from the UK perspective in terms of navigating this existing complex pathway, I think it's not theoretical resource, but you've got to sort of find people that can hear you as a clinician. There's this particular paper that was brought to my attention on LinkedIn recently, Deborah Jackson's paper around how niceness in nursing can equally be toxic. It's you as a clinician taking that agency, running with your gut feeling in terms of enthusiasm to go and find that pathway for yourself, because the pathway doesn't exist. And for that to happen, you've got to surround yourself with people who are like-minded. So there's a level in the northwest of England. We have things like the NHS R&D internship pathways, opportunities that can sort of give you a break to stop doing, to start thinking. And you'll find people who are in different bandings to yourself, who are also in the same place you are in the context of your research capabilities. And that itself gives you that community you can be part of. Now you have quite a lot of NIHR senior research leaders, and one of them that you can sort of drop them an email and they would wrap around support around you. Sometimes nobody's asking you to write a paper. Nobody's asking you to write a bead. Sometimes you just want to stay close to the evidence. And you staying close to the evidence can help you to translate that to your clinical practice. And what I hear from colleagues that I've done that with is it gives them that joy to say, you know, this is why I came into nursing, to make that difference. So I think in the value-driven space we find ourselves in the UK, it's you finding those people who your values align, who can see your passion, who wouldn't say to you, you're trying to fly before you can walk, who will actually see the enthusiasm and guide you on the right path. And it doesn't mean it's going to work, but for your conscience, you would tell yourself, I tried.
Yeah, that was a really good point. I think in terms of going through the questions that I've got here, that's kind of the last of the core things I want to ask. What I normally ask our guests to do is, with our listeners, could you leave them kind of three key points or three key takeaways to help kind of summarize what we've talked about here today? And also in terms of what parting advice you'd like to leave them with in terms of getting more involved in research or kind of just being more aware of the different styles of it or that kind of thing?
I think my key point would really be that the US model seems to normalize and celebrate that curiosity among nurses a bit more. And I think if we nurture that same mindset here, we'll empower nurses, you know, improve care and improve patient outcomes. But I think it's just harnessing that curiosity. It exists. We've got the raw talent. It's just taking it, supporting it. And I think just providing that almost safety net for nurses that they can do research, you know, and that it is accessible and make it more accessible. I know that's not really a very, you know, succinct key point, but I think it's just harness that curiosity and support that curiosity.
I think for me it would be for different audiences, and I'll give you a shot. That for operations colleagues, I think it's time to start thinking about research being the first step before care. For you to deliver good care, you've got to have a robust evidence. This idea of relying on what we think we know is clearly not working. And then I'll talk to clinicians who are on the front line, your band 5, your band 6s, and to an extent to your band 7s. I think it's saying very clearly, in a very gentle way to say, you know, your clinical audits, the service evaluations, the quality improvement piece of work you are doing quietly, let's start to do it properly. Because in that lies our credibility as a profession. And we're also going to have that reward, because the reward about we came here to make a difference. This is a great way to make that difference, leaving the profession better than how you met it. And I think to my colleagues who are in the education sector, nurse educator, nurse academics, what I want to brand ourselves, we need to stop dumbing down research in our conversations. We need to teach and assess critical appraisers. We need to teach our students can pick up a paper at level 4 and start to be critical of what they are reading. I can recall people saying to me, oh, it's just level 4. We just want them to describe. You're not going to ram critical appraisal to them in level 6. You start from level 4 and allow them, give them the permission to not know. And if we also need to go and educate ourselves, let's do that. And let's not keep creating the future that we were part of. We need to get these guys to think in different ways. And for me, it's also how we can start to bring in improvement methods into our teaching, and more importantly, data literacy. For the life of me, it's really, really heartbreaking when you see people qualify and they write notes because it's what they do, but are they really thinking digitally? Are they thinking of the consequences of what they are writing and what they are not writing? For an example, we note now that, and this is a particular book I wrote recently for a different outfit, we know that your minoritized ethnic community patients, mental health patients, for example, that there's a high chance that they are given rapid tranquilization. So medications, that itself tells us there's something. So when you're documenting something like that on your note, you want to reflect that in your writing. That's an example of how you translate evidence into practice. Oh, Hyam was given, you wrote the position, but you didn't say anything about the patient's ethnicity. You don't have any interpretation of the data. You as a clinician is autonomous. You must be able to offer your thinking without thinking somebody's going to judge you. So right from undergraduate, we need to start thinking how we can support that data literacy, because it's as crucial as the outcome that patients will get as well. I hope that's not so much.
No, that was great. I think that was two points in one, but also it's nice to end on kind of one big change you'd like to see, or kind of one key development, or one kind of closing thought to leave our listeners with? And I feel like digital literacy is a really important part of that, because it kind of summarizes a lot of the aspects of research while also kind of looking at one of the more kind of intimidating factors related to research that we've covered quite a few times over the course of the episode. Yeah, fantastic. I think that's a really nice note I'd like to end it on. Well, Adayo and Deborah, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us, Sean. Enjoyed it.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the BJN podcast. We release new episodes every week, so make sure you tune in next time, where we'll be bringing you a new insight into the wider world of nursing. If you'd like to follow up on the subject in greater detail, please check out the BJN website at www.britishjournalofnursing.com.